Can you hear the music, Robert? Yes, I can.
Now will come some sort of dumb, melodramatic sob story where you highlight your broken interiority. Something like, I don't know.
We mothers stand still so our daughters can look back to see how far they've come.
Sometimes a couple is kind of a chaos and everybody is lost.
Is it my destiny to live and die a life of blood fragility? I'm just kidding.
These vampires are my dog.
All I needed was a love you gave.
I was a lesbian for a while, you know. But it was all just too wet for me in the end. Men are so lovely and dry.
Only hope is the sweet relief of death.
It's an elevator in a goddamn trap house. It doesn't make your spider senses tingle.
Everyone keeps telling me how my story is supposed to go.
Not your father. You're your own man.
Why me? I don't know. I'm special, I guess.
I am the Fury.
Simeon, Alvin, along came John, talking about movies as their only job. So wouldn't the pod about movies be fun? For all you know, this is the only one that will be fun.
Hello and welcome to Movie Pod, a Great Fans podcast, where we discuss all things movies, past, present, and occasionally future. My name is Sammy Chester, and today marks the long-awaited return of the pod to decide the best movie of the past year, 2023. In this case, 32 movies that will be going head-to-head in this year's bracket to determine the champion are competing for second place. An executive decision was made since Chris Nolan's Oppenheimer is objectively, I would argue, unquestionably the movie achievement of weak movie year. And so it's loads more fun to make the bracket a free-for-all where everyone's competing for next best movie to Nolan's Oppenheimer. This bracket is also a bit different in that my co-hosts cut bait over the past year, and so the pod is temporarily a one-man show. Somewhat related to that, today's bracket lacks some of the bells and whistles of years past. Won't be any audio clips to pause us from listeners as we go. Instead, hopefully we'll have listeners, and you know we have Jim, we have Alex right now, who will be joining this chat live as we run through the bracket. Preambles aside, I want to share a few quick trends, guys, that I saw in the past movie year. As I said, I am convinced it wasn't the strongest of years. One group which is very present for me is World War II. Oppenheimer, Godzilla, Boy and the Heron, the other movie from Japan, Zone of Interest, the Holocaust movie, two movies that, you know, spoilers are in my top 10, Sisu and Lola. A lot of World War II, but again, not like the movie from last year about World War I, which was very much a war movie about World War I. A lot of movies about World War II that, for instance, Oppenheimer, it's not a war movie per se, though, you know, we discussed that perhaps, which I still think it ultimately is. It's showing you a strong element that goes into war production, weapon creation, etc. But a lot of World War II, and I don't really know why so many World War II movies came together. It might have been, given my own context, given some of, you know, what's been going on where I live and some of the military conflict, you know, given maybe the overshadow of Ukraine, but who knows. So one is World War II, and a second one very quickly for me is Professors. You know, Jim, we have you on, so you can hopefully speak to this. Oppenheimer, Holdovers, American Fiction, Dream Scenario, the Nicolas Cage movie, a lot of confused, challenged, and otherwise in tough places professor movies this year. So World War II and Professors to me are the two most obvious shared narratives across movies.
Yeah, I'd say like a continued trend of biopics with Killers of the Flower Moon, Oppenheimer.
Villa, sort of the Elvis package deal, and you know, Napoleon, Ferrari.
I agree with the ones you're seeing. I didn't see as many movies as I wanted yet this year, as I mentioned in the chat.
I'll give you two more. So one, maybe a lot of like relationship, even romance stories that were set in some sort of pseudo alternative future sci-fi type scenario. Biosphere, Fingernails, Jesse Buckley movie. If you were the last two astronauts who are sort of stuck up on like the International Space Station or an imagined version of that. All of Us Strangers seems to be sort of set in somewhat of a dystopian alternative future. I didn't like Fingernails. If you were the last, I wouldn't recommend Biosphere and All of Us Strangers. We'll get to in the bracket. I like a lot more. maybe I'm just drawn to that kind of setup where you have a complicated relationship and then you add on to it. It's not sci-fi in the way people associate that term, but it's certainly not the present and set somewhere in the not too distant future. So that was another one. And then the very last one were penises. They popped up a lot more on screen than I'm used to seeing. And, you know, I don't maybe go out to see the right movies, but a lot of movies about male-on-male relationships, which I do appreciate. Again, All of Us Strangers, a gay relationship. Passages, a movie with my favorite actor, French movie, gay relationships. The Japanese director of Shoplifters and a few others called Monster. A lot of critics interpret Monster as ultimately the two boys have sort of a gay relationship. I don't interpret it like that, but certainly it's about a male-on-male relationship. Biosphere, as we mentioned, maybe we can get into. Tetris. Tetris works so well, and it's about a really, really beautiful relationship between two men. Again, a friendship. But a male-on-male relationships somewhat also spiraled into movies like Bo is Afraid and Saltburn and even Poor Things, where there were quite a few wags down there for any number of men. So Bo is Afraid, it kind of throws it in your face, the massive penis monster.
Definitely does, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Before we start the bracket, guys, so what is a movie that you either saw or you would like to see, and you're looking at the bracket and you're like, holy heck, Sammy, how did you make a bracket and did not include X?
As I mentioned in the chat, for me, it was Asteroid City. Haven't seen most of the movies on this bracket, and I did see Asteroid City, and better than maybe all the ones that I did see that you have on the bracket. So I was a little bit surprised by that.
I can tell you, Jim, plan to see all the Wes Anderson movies that came out in 2023, which for those people who may not know, he released four shorts on Netflix called The Wonderful Life of Henry Sugar, The Swan, Ratcatcher, and Poison. And they're all somewhat set in the same universe. Three of them are like 10 minutes, and the first one, Henry Sugar, I think is like 40 minutes.
Based on Roald Dahl short stories.
Yeah, the Asteroid City on top of those. And I didn't manage to see, I think, The Swan. And therefore, I never got to the Asteroid City. And therefore, I kind of obviously wouldn't put in a movie that I didn't see in terms of Asteroid City. I feel that Wes Anderson is all the same. It's all like the same kind of overstimulated tea for me. It just feels like a very, very sugary tea. My last reason why I didn't put it in, Jim, is that I think Poor Things to me was sort of like a Wes Anderson-like movie. After I saw Poor Things yesterday, it was the last movie I saw before this bracket, I figured, hey, you know, Poor Things will represent Wes Anderson. But I do like what is the Roald Dahl that Alex mentioned that you can see on Netflix.
My top movies of the year, I think you have everything represented. Asteroid City was my next one you didn't, and then Bottoms.
There's another movie I think that didn't make it in called Polite Society, funny comedy set with two women. I thought Polite Society was more fun than Bottoms. Bottoms gets a bit hokey at the end, very violent.
Oh yeah, I feel like it'd be in the 34, 35 spot probably for someone who saw as many movies as you do.
I think I saw like 75, 76 movies, of which 35 of them or so I like and I would recommend. Top five for me that I don't recommend, their movies ranked 38 and on, are movies that I still think sort of people would engage and probably people like. So one of them is Bottoms that you mentioned, Alex. Another one is John Wick 4, Past Lives, which I think is in the bracket. I don't really recommend, but then again, there are 37 movies above those that I did like. So for me, it's not a movie year that outside of my top 10, there aren't movies that I kind of would be like, oh, you have to go see those. Literally my 33rd, but also the one that didn't make the bracket is a French movie called Night of the 12th. I would recommend it. True crime thriller with strong societal sort of feminist themes. It's about a policeman investigating an unsolved mystery of a young woman. While watching it, I kind of kept thinking this might have been better as a true crime podcast or maybe even like a Netflix series. Before we start the bracket and begin with our number one overall seed, or number two overall seed in this case, a quick reminder, the seedings are based on the average critic scores from Rotten Tomatoes, IMDb, Letterboxd, Metacritic, etc. So while more so than most years, the movies in the bracket were very much influenced by me alone, the seeding is not of my choosing. Happy to start breaking down brackets. Let's start with our first matchup in the top left, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse going up against Extraction 2. Spider-Man, of course, is a sequel. Extraction 2 makes no bones about it being the sequel. High octane sequels. Jim, which of these two gets your pick?
So I have seen the originals of both of these. And just based on what I've heard and on that, I guess I've got to go with Spider-Man.
I couldn't even tell you what Extraction or Extraction 2 are about. I have no clue. So for me, it's a strong...
Extraction 1 is forgettable. The second one, though, has some really fun action scenes. There's this whole like one shot where he's breaking someone out of a prison. Literally, he's doing an extraction. The whole movie's on Netflix, obviously. That whole scene is pretty much on YouTube. To me, that's better than anything in John Wick 4. It's better than anything in like a Mission Impossible the last few years. Visceral and live, and Hemsworth delivers it so well. And so that's Extraction 2, better than Extraction 1. Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, we'll talk about a bit more because it gets my vote and it's going to advance. There's a reason that it's the number one seed, again, as fighting for the runner-up to Oppenheimer here. Powerful themes, it has wonderful characters. It really goes at you nonstop from the first second with incredible animation that we've never seen before. Let's see who it's going to face next. Number 16, Barbie. Number 17, How to Have Sex. Barbie, a movie we're all familiar with. How to Have Sex, a movie probably none of us are. How to Have Sex is a small British indie set in Greece, which is sort of the Florida for Brits, if not Portugal, I suppose. Party town, village in Greece with these two female, I think seniors in high school, you know, so to speak, virgins, and about how they're kind of descent into the madness of the pressure, partying and hooking up and everything related to that. Despite the sort of gotcha title, it's a very sobering look. It's very well made. The lead actress is really good. And it's not a movie by any means that encourages you to drink, do drugs, or have sex. So, you know, the title's a bit of a challenge to the audience in terms of what it's actually messaging you. It's a tough title to search. Typing how to have sex into like download via forms can get you into a bit of trouble, but it's worth it. How to Have Sex, Barbie, which of these, if any, is getting your guys' pick?
How to Have Sex sounds interesting, but I'm going to go with Barbie in the first round. It seemed like too much of an upset to knock it out right away.
Two matching up as they are in the first round is obviously appropriate. There's a through line through Barbie, but you know, these characters don't really know how to have sex despite the sort of heteronormative sheen that is set in the world and the toys of Barbie. I'm like you, Jim. I think we spoke about Barbie at the time when we discussed Oppenheimer earlier this year. I think Barbie has a lot of gaps. A lot of it just isn't really so great, but it has a production design and sort of a joy in its best moments. Some of its songs, some of what it does with Ryan Gosling and Ken is really great. How to Have Sex is a well-made movie. It's like a movie you should show to teenagers so that they won't, you know, mess around and do drugs. And yet Barbie doing a bit more in a number of different ways. Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, Barbie, second round matchup right away. It's going to be Spider-Verse for me. Spider-Verse is just doing a whole lot more, but at a polished, really high level throughout. While Barbie has times where I was kind of like rolling my eyes or I was a bit bored. Feminist speech toward the end, it feels very forced. Next two movies, The Beast versus They Clone Tyrone. The Beast is a Spanish language movie. A middle-class couple that have moved from France to Spain to sort of a poor village. Poor villagers there don't accept them. And there starts being a lot of kind of like neighbor-on-neighbor violence. Say the lead is very much Sopranos' James Gandolfini vibe. He's like this kind of big, heavyset guy who's trying to sort of protect his family. But again, he's not a mobster. He's just like a middle-class, like former professor. They Clone Tyrone, again, a Netflix movie, like a 1960s black empowerment movie, set in sort of a weird sci-fi alternative universe with like shades of Get Out. It's not taking itself too seriously and kind of having a good time throughout.
I watched about the first 10 minutes of They Clone Tyrone with my wife. Neither of us was really getting into it and I never went back. So I'll go with The Beast.
They Clone Tyrone, I have it as my number 5 of the year. So I'm going to stick with that.
Sort of a similar incident as the characters in The Beast. I had a neighbor, not a direct neighbor, but I had someone who lives in the town over accost me over sort of a road rage incident a few months ago. Something very similar happens in The Beasts. It's a very tense scene and obviously kind of hit me in a more personal way. Push number 24, They Clone Tyrone ahead and see who it's going to be playing. Number 8, All of Us Strangers versus number 25, Priscilla. Priscilla is about Priscilla Presley. It's sort of the twin to last year's Elvis movie. In contrast to a loud, noisy Baz Luhrmann movie about Elvis, Priscilla is directed by Sofia Coppola. Very understated. How would you describe All of Us Strangers?
Sort of like an adult version of a child being able to see his deceased parents and interact with them. There's a relationship he has with another character as well that's central to it.
Kind of a homosexual relationship between the main character, a man in his 40s, and a younger male person he meets. And then there's also sort of the relationship he has with his parents who died in a car accident 20 years before, but he's re-engaging them, I guess, as some sort of ghosts, like ghost story almost, you know, a bit more viscerally. Hard on its sleeve type movie. I think if it doesn't work for someone, would only be because we found it was just like too much, too emotional, too sort of straight at you. I found it similar, but far better for me as 2022, last year's After Sun. After Sun was a kind of emotionally affecting movie that didn't emotionally affect me, about a relationship between a father and a daughter. And so the daughter reimagining some of her past life with her father. Both have the same actor, Paul Mescal. But All of Us Strangers just worked so well for me. One of my favorite movies of the year, easily beating out Priscilla. Priscilla's a movie that may be similar to Zone of Interest, which will pop up later. The understatedness works for the theme of the movie, but it also kind of loses the audience at some point. It's very, very understated. I mean, basically, it's almost like a horror movie. Again, like Zone of Interest, Priscilla is captured within this beautiful home. Predatory Elvis kind of like spins around and expects her to, you know, just always be there at his beck and whim. But All of Us Strangers emotionally is just doing so much more in a very unique fashion. Alex, it sounds like you would pick They Clone Tyrone, which is the next matchup, number 24, Clone Tyrone versus number 8, All of Us Strangers, in the next round matchup.
They Clone Tyrone is having a lot of fun with its concept. Really great performances from Jamie Foxx, John Boyega. All of Us Strangers, while the parents are great, the last 5 to 10 minutes sort of lets down what's been going on. Doubles down on the twist or premise of the movie, yeah. Then it's a little falls flat.
I did listen to a few podcasts by some gay movie critics that I really, really admire, where they said the homosexual relationship part is what was strongest for them, because the different generational, an older gay man, a younger gay man, and, you know, all the different kind of how each of them came out in a different way. Each of them has a different relationship about their homosexual identity, the terms they use, the drugs they use, the partying, the way they party, et cetera, the relationship with alcohol. They found that incredibly accurate and, you know, honest. And just the relation, the personality of Andrew Scott, the lead, versus Paul Mescal. None of that, I think, worked on the same level for me. And therefore, the way the movie comes back to that relationship at the end, as you said, in sort of the wow, or the sort of maybe unnecessarily extra emotional punch, it struck me as a bit forced, simply because to me, the relationship with the parents was the driving heart of the movie. One of the most powerful relationships between a child and the parents I've seen on screen in years. And therefore, the movie really peaked and didn't need to sort of emotionally try to peak again at that diner scene a few minutes before. When Andrew Scott, the lead in All of Us Strangers, is engaging his parents really emotionally toward the end of the movie at a diner scene, that to me, Alex, was the peak of the movie. And therefore, I'm sympathetic to what you're saying. I'm going to have to tell you you're wrong and overrule you. And All of Us Strangers is going into the third round. So it's going to be Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse against All of Us Strangers. But let's get back to that and very quickly jump over to the right side of the bracket. On the right side of the bracket, we have our number 2 overall, The Holdovers, another Professor movie, going up against The Iron Claw. Not a Professor movie, maybe the very opposite of that. Iron Claw is about a real life family of Texas wrestlers. It was at the 70s, 80s, I suppose. Calamities and tragedies that befall them due to a very tough father figure. And The Holdovers is also about a father figure of sorts. Paul Giamatti plays a prep school professor who stays over Christmas and kind of participates in the ultimate Christmas movie.
I saw The Holdovers. I think it's highly overrated. I have not seen Iron Cage yet, but I will heard good things, so I will go with Iron Cage. I didn't feel like it was saying anything new that hadn't already been said in similar prep school movies. Didn't see what the buzz was about.
I agree with you, Jim, that it's in my top 10. I don't think it's a special movie. I don't think it's a movie outside of a warm hug feeling, if I want that, that I'll be as, oh, wow, that was a top movie of the decade or whatever it is. But it's just like a movie I had a really, really positive time with. And the actors were just fun to spend time with. And if it would have been another hour, I think I would have watched it for another hour, because I just wanted to be with those characters longer.
Not usually high on Alexander Payne movies, but The Holdovers pretty much worked off the back of Paul Giamatti for me alone.
This is like a Paul Giamatti performance that I think it's very hard not to go for. I like how his jokes are bad. I like how when he finally takes a stand, you sort of feel this is a defining experience for a very average, mediocre fellow. Iron Claw, I think, is nicer shot. The first half, it seems like every single scene is being shot at dawn as the sun is coming up. Brothers having this beautiful relationship. I think what doesn't work in Iron Claw for me, besides the fact that I don't care anything for pro wrestling in the 70s or 80s, everything seems somewhat as a remove. And maybe that's because, and I don't think the lead actor does such a great job, Zac Efron, this distance from how is he really relating and taking in the fact that his life is being hit over and over and over with these body blows as his brothers keep kind of running into all sorts of calamities. So The Holdover is an easy win. 15-18, always a close matchup. Falcon Lake is a French movie, which I did sneak into the bracket because, hey, you know, I formed the bracket this year with little challenge. It's a movie set, a 12-year-old boy goes off to his parents' summer home near this beautiful lake, I guess called Falcon Lake. And there he comes completely infatuated and in love with an older girl. I guess she would be like 15 or 16 and he's like 12. And it's all about their sort of summertime romance. Speaking to what Jim said about the holdovers, I feel like I've seen Falcon Lake, that sort of story before. You know, the 12-year-old boy, the 16-year-old girl, even the sandlot, the lifeguard in the sandlot and the sort of squeaky little boy, like teen infatuation, that sense of romance that just inundates that summer experience. It makes it so the movie really, really works. And one of the things I see in my notes for Falcon Lake, I say, oh, wow, the script was so good. And again, this is a movie in French. I was reading subtitles. When it's a foreign language movie and you feel the script is working, it's because the script is working in the context of the mood and the characters, even if you don't really understand what they're saying. So Falcon Lake at number 15 here, how to blow up a pipeline. Jim, can you tell us how to blow up a pipeline? Or Alex, can you tell me what the movie's about?
I was looking at the bracket a couple hours ago and was like, what movie can I squeeze in just before we get on the call? So I just watched this one, actually. It was pretty good. Made my, you know, top 15 movies of the year.
You know, not to beat up on They Clone Tyrone, but I would say They Clone Tyrone, How to Blow Up a Pipeline, kind of a similar vibe for me, which was like fun and I'd recommend, but it's not a movie I'm going to particularly remember. This is a movie about environmental activists get together in West Texas to, as the movie title suggests, to blow up a pipeline. Don't worry, the movie doesn't actually, Jim, tell us exactly what chemicals and other elements you need to put together. Oppenheimer will give you a lot more instruction on how to build the bomb than these guys do. This, though, will tell you, if you do want to blow up a pipeline, which kind of crazy environmentalists to reach out to, because they have each of them kind of typecast.
The Greenpeace, like Ocean's 11.
Something that does sort of complicate and show you how maybe going around blowing up pipelines isn't really the way. Maybe this kind of aggressive violence isn't necessarily the right way to push for your social cause. How to Blow Up a Pipeline is actually a book that they just took the title from, and it's a book by a professor. And the book isn't about blowing up pipelines. The book is about him making the argument why particularly environmental activists need to take more proactive, aggressive steps to advocate for their cause. So he says it's not enough to just do hunger strikes and just to stand around with signs. We need to actually go out if we want to save the environment and actually blow things up. And the movie is showing what that call to action would actually be. The movie more grappled with the argument as to why they should be doing this rather than just showing them doing it. But putting that aside, I think I'm going to give Falcon Lake my advantage here because it really kind of spoke to me and it had like a core emotion that How to Blow Up a Pipeline never touched. To me, Holdovers is going to roll over both of them. Let's see who's going to face them there. We have some heavy hitters in the bottom of this top right corner bracket. Number 10, Killers of the Flower Moon versus Play-In. So we'll see who gets the number 23 seed, which is Monster versus Chile 1976. So let's go to that Play-In first. Monster is directed again by the Japanese director who's made Shoplifters a few years ago. Monster is very different. It's about a Japanese teacher who's said to have abused a 10-year-old boy in elementary school in Japan. And then the movie shows you first the mother's perspective, the mother of that boy. Then it shows you the teacher's perspective. And then it shows you the boy's perspective. You never actually see almost anything the same way. Every single time you go back over the same timeline, you see it with a lot more meaning and a lot more perspective, and it gives the movie a lot more content. What a lot of people talk about this movie, if you read a review, Monster really shows you that the truth is not what you think. To me, that's not that interesting. What's interesting, the relationship between the two boys and what's communicated therein. Ultimately, I don't really recommend it. Chile 1976 is set in Chile. If you can guess it, in the year 1976, it's about a middle-class woman who's sort of slow dawning realization of how she should protest and become more active against her government. Maybe the best female performance of the year. Again, it's a woman in her 50s who's kind of introduced by accident to this young 20-year-old boy who's been injured in some sort of anti-government action. And then it's kind of her choice to shelter him and to help him, to, you know, provide him with medical aid. Understated, definitely a slow burn, but really, really well done. I'm going to give my vote to Chile 76 over Monster, and it's going to go immediately up against Killers of the Flower Moon, the Scorsese movie that was many hours long on Netflix this year.
Killers, I think, was one of the most affecting movies for me this year. Very good performances from De Niro and Leonardo DiCaprio, and then Lily Gladstone, obviously really, really great in it. Sheer brutality of these, like, they're not even smart thugs that have just taken advantage and latched onto the Osage people like parasites and are slowly sucking the life out of them.
How when the feds finally intervene and sort of solve the crime and kind of prosecute the crime so quickly, it almost comes as a surprise because the movie had established in its kind of slow pacing until then that this was just the reality, as you said, Alex. Like this was, there was no way out. The Osage were sort of being, as you said, slowly sucked dry to the point when they would just push Killers of the Flower Moon through. Number 7, The Zone of Interest versus number 26, Dungeons and Dragons. Now, The Zone of Interest, Spielberg called it in a very kind of egotistical Hollywood way, the best Holocaust movie since My Holocaust Movie. I like how he threw in the word my. It's a movie that shows you, without ever seeing any of the horrors of the Holocaust, it shows you sort of the day-to-day life that's happening in the home of this Nazi official right next to the camp without the sort of camp life ever directly intervening except through the ears and the audio of the story. And then Dungeons and Dragons is, of course, a very similar story, which you could say is about a bunch of characters coming together to oppose, I don't know, overweight dragons. I'm not really sure what they're opposing in Dungeons and Dragons. I guess they're fighting against red witches, or I can't even remember. All I know is Dungeons and Dragons was a lot of fun, and it's a movie that I guess is going to be made a lot of sequels of until eventually it goes straight to video, and certainly one of the most fun movies of the first half of the year. The movie strikes that kind of like MCU balance between humor and action and sort of character interplay. Not all the characters really work for me. I don't really want to see 10 more kind of Dungeons and Dragons type movies. As someone who has a soft spot for that world, call it early 90s high fantasy, I like sometimes the sort of seriousness of that's set in that world, like the Raistlin Karaman brothers, you know, tension, if I'm going to really nerd out here for a second. You don't get that in Dungeons and Dragons. Everything is a bit too goofy. Nothing really matters, ultimately. Dungeons and Dragons, Zone of Interest.
These are probably the two most opposite of the pairings on the board. So it's hard to really even compare them, but I agree with everything you said. Like Dungeons and Dragons came in and was just probably way better than it had any right to be. Zone of Interest, very important movie, but brutal and chilling and not something I would ever want to watch again. Like I didn't particularly obviously enjoy the experience and would have to go Dungeons and Dragons over Zone of Interest, but that's such a difficult comparison.
Zone of Interest, the conceit in the movie is so overwhelming and it's very well done, which is that you're seeing a very boring, bland story with even bland, you know, camera work. And yet the reason everything is so bland is because the audio and the overall kind of context of the Holocaust is communicating the theme. And therefore, that overwhelming theme of the blandness you're watching on screen is the power of the movie. And the blandness is there for a reason, but it also makes it where, like, I don't ever want to go back and see The Zone of Interest, because even though I couldn't look away while I was watching it because I knew that overarching theme and I appreciated what the director was doing, what I actually was watching was very boring. You know, it's just watching this like German family like go swimming and like and tend their garden and have their grandmother visit. And none of that is like particularly interesting.
Agree if you have the sound off, but while they're doing all these activities, ash is floating down their river and the screams and the barking of dogs and gunshots, and that juxtaposition is just so unsettling. And
also the audio, just on a technical level, is done much better than the audio has ever done on this podcast. You know, the audio, obviously, the audio is done in a way where there is a, you know, a discordant, different audio playing even as the people are speaking and having their lives. There wasn't enough there in terms of the acting, in terms of the script, in terms of the camera work. Outside of the audio and a few gimmicks by the director, I kind of was like, Zone of Interest was very powerful, but it didn't really get me. While Dungeons and Dragons was a fun time that I also didn't really feel I needed to watch, and I probably won't watch again, and therefore I'm going to give Zone of Interest my advantage. Killers of the Flower Moon versus Zone of Interest. I think Alex spoke to sort of how some of the similarities between these two movies, you know, two different communities that are like, seem to be caught, impossible to escape. I didn't love Killers of the Flower Moon. I just felt that a lot of what it was trying to say, I got very early on, and then it just kind of seemed to go on and on. I didn't find Gladstone's performance particularly interesting, to be frank. Actually, her sisters or some of the other women, the Osage tribe, I thought were a bit more interesting. And therefore, Zone of Interest, it's the movie I'm going to remember much more, and it's a movie I would like recommend. If you're only going to see one, you should see Zone of Interest over Killers of the Flower Moon. In this top quadrant, we're going to have The Holdovers and Zone of Interest, the number 2 and the number 7. But let's drop down to the bottom right, and we'll leave that Elite 8 matchup for when we spin back around.
If we jump to the third corner, the bottom right of the bracket, the theme really of most of the movies here is not only World War II, but it's the legacy of World War II. And we'll see that in a lot of the movies, including in our first matchup, which is number 3 seed Godzilla Minus One versus number 30 seed Fair Play. Godzilla Minus One is Godzilla by the Japanese production studio through the lens of post-World War II, with the Japanese society dealing with the legacy of World War II and now having to deal with one of those legacies, which in this case is a monster, atomic breath-breathing dinosaur. Fair Play is a bit different. Not World War II, but conflict nonetheless. It's set in the world of Wall Street in contemporary times, and it shows two young Wall Street wannabes who are also engaged to be married without their boss's knowledge. And it shows how they compete within that cutthroat world. Fair Play, number 30. Godzilla Minus One, number 3.
I had not even heard of this one. The only Fair Play I know is on Survivor. Yeah, I'm definitely more in the camp for Godzilla Minus One. It's a top 5 movie of 2023.
Maybe. Fair Play, we never knew ya. Number 14, Sisu, a Finnish World War II movie, versus number 19, Lola. Sisu very much plays like Inglourious Basterds. It's an old Finnish curmudgeon who just wanted to take his gold that he found while mining off in the mountains of Finland and take it back to the town in Finland. Bastard Nazis get in his way, and he just kind of goes Tarantino on them. It's very, very stylistic action. There's like a Mad Max from a few years ago. The Nazis, for reasons I don't exactly recall, have kidnapped a bunch of Finnish women. Mad Max sort of style, where they help him and they sort of comment upon his bravery and his tenacity. I guess Sisu means tenacity, if nothing else, perseverance. Now, number 19, Lola, would be my number one overlooked movie of the year.
Again, a World War II movie about two British sisters that have built a device they call Lola that can play radio and TV broadcasts from the future. Initially, they use this device to interact with songs and movies from the 1960s and the 1970s, but then they quickly realize that the device can also help Britain win the war against Nazi Germany. The movie is framed as found footage, with the one sister always filming their escapades. And so what we are watching as the audience is what one of the characters in the movie is filming of their adventures. In practice, most of this low-budget indie movie was filmed by splicing World War II archive footage. So the people who made the movie apparently took footage from World War II of Churchill and Hitler and others, and then they kind of Forrest Gump style edited that footage to put in the scenes that they filmed of their characters with an old-timey camera. So there's a lot going on behind the camera with this very low-budget movie. What is fascinating in Lola is how the film is presented, the questions it raises on how we shape our present and the future, and the two rich characters at the center. It also has a very fun soundtrack, since, as I mentioned, the two sisters are engaging music from the 60s, like Dylan and Bowie and others, and bringing it back into the context of World War II.
It's going up against Sisu. These are two movies that, spoilers, are both in my top 5. Both of them are World War II movies. Based upon what you heard from my description of them, which one would give you the edge, Alex? Sisu, which is like a rock'em sock'em stylistic Tarantino and Glorious Bastards set in Finland, but there's almost no dialogue, by the way. And I think the Nazis speak English, like in English. So it's pretty much an English language movie almost. The guy never talks. I don't think he says something the entire time. Lola, like seeing the future and grappling with how they can change the past.
Sisu sounds pretty cool. I feel like I almost went and saw it when it was in theaters, but Lola, just based on your description and me looking at the Letterboxd page, I think is something I'll probably be watching like within the next couple weeks.
This is the hardest matchup for me so far in the first round, both in my top 5, both movies I would highly recommend. I just think Sisu is the most fun action movie we've had in several years. I just don't think you can really go wrong. There's one scene where the guy is like swimming under a river as the Nazis shoot him and shoot mines at him and kind of kills this Nazi underwater. And then he breathes through the windpipe of the Nazi underling he's killed under the water in order to like get more oxygen and stay underwater so he isn't killed.
Wow.
So
I say,
like, see Zone of Interest and see Sisu afterwards to like, you know, balance that out. But Lola's gonna get my pick as well. Lola doesn't completely work. It becomes a bit too telegraphed, which is funny enough since it's a movie about being able to see the future and then allow that future to transform how you act in the present. Lola, number 19, is gonna get my pick. It's gonna go up against Godzilla Minus One. These are both in my top 10. I'll tell you my limitations, Alex, for Godzilla. plays mm-hmm. too much sort of like a Japanese manga at times. It has like the crusty old captain and the fun teenage boy. A lot of the acting and the characters are just very overwrought. It's Godzilla. I'm not asking too much of it. I think could have had even more kind of Japanese World War II type guilt. The World War II element, it's very internally facing, while anyone who knows Japan and World War II, like Japan, far beyond how their own responsibilities internally, it was also like what they did to the Koreans, to the Chinese and others. Godzilla Minus One could have grappled even a bit more with kind of real world World War II type legacies. Doesn't do so, and it has kind of, it's like cutesy manga vibe. And some of that took me out of the movie. You know, I'd be happy with either one of these advancing. Which one is going to get your pick based upon what you've heard of Lola and what you liked in Godzilla?
I feel like that's a criticism that people have said of Oppenheimer, that it focuses, you know, totally on the making of the bomb and not any of the consequences necessarily. So I just thought that was a cool parallel. Or I can go with Lola.
Say, I was going to defer to you and say we could push Godzilla forward, but let's make Bracket Chaos and push Lola forward. I do think it's close. I just think Lola is more unconventional while still being a very kind of safe conventional movie, meaning frantic pacing, it has a love story, everything's in English. Like, it's not an intimidating movie to watch by any means. Godzilla Minus One is like, you know, maybe the most recommendable movie to like almost any audience. Let's go to the bottom corner and close out this corner of the bracket. Number 11, Close Your Eyes versus number 22, Tetris. Now, Close Your Eyes is one of those, if Sam had a co-host, which if anyone's listening to this, and Alex, you know, you're welcome to get back to me as well. I would love to have engaged and committed, you know, other voices joining in any regularity. Why I mention all that is that Close Your Eyes is a movie that wouldn't have made this bracket if I would have had a second voice pushing back against me. Close Your Eyes is, I want to say, like an almost 3-hour Spanish language foreign movie that's like very, very much like a celebrated European art director who I've never heard of. I didn't love the whole movie. The pacing in most of the movie is very slow and doesn't quite get to me. But it quietly builds up something that's really, really strong. The movie is all about how there's a famous actor who disappeared like 20 years ago. And the director of his last movie that I think he disappeared during the making of is now coming to terms with the fact that the actor might be out there. And, you know, spoilers, he does find his, you know, long lost friend actor over the course of the movie. And so the director, who's this kind of bitter Paul Giamatti, the Holdovers type character, is kind of rediscovering over the course of the movie his relationship to his past directing and movie making and the making of art. Spoilers, he finds his former actor best friend, and the two of them connect in a sort of old men grizzled looking back on their lifetime of being creative artists. Not a movie I'd recommend to most audiences. I think it's ranked in my like 30s or so, but there was enough there. And as you can guess by this kind of movie, the critics eat this movie up. So therefore it has a high rating. That's why it's number 11 here. I'm giving my vote to Tetris, though. Tetris was one of the best times I had at movies in years. I love Tetris. I know there are some people who thought the Nike movie about the release of the first pair of Jordan sneakers, Air, or the BlackBerry movie, some people like those other more. Some people like Ferrari maybe more. I just felt Tetris worked so well. The metaphor worked so well, which is the Berlin Wall and the walls surrounding the Soviet world, and those walls coming down is very much what Tetris was designed to communicate. And it's a movie about friendship. It's a movie about a father and a daughter. It's a movie that's just really fun, easily rolls over, Close Your Eyes.
Like a 3-hour art house movie. And it's called Close Your Eyes. It's a little ironic, yeah. I think. But I don't know if I'm going to be seeing that one, but I'll probably end up finishing Tetris at some point.
The Boy and the Heron in the final matchup in this bracket. The Boy and the Heron, number 6, going up against Saltburn, number 27. The director of Saltburn is a female director.
Fennel?
Previously made the number one movie of 2 years ago, according to the Worldly Pod. Drumroll, please.
Promising
Young Woman. Saltburn is Emerald Fennell's follow-up with a lot of kind of like hot young thing actors these days, including Elvis from Priscilla. I guess you could say a gay old time about a lower class British sot just causes chaos and ruckus as he kind of takes his revenge against his upper class elitist peers. A lot more violence and kind of like sexual tension in Saltburn than you may expect. The Boy and the Heron is the latest and possibly final and seems to be the most personal Studio Ghibli movie made by its founding or most famous director, Miyazaki. While I liked it, it seems ultimately like a mishmash and it doesn't do anything particularly distinct. And if you don't know that it's also based in large part upon like the World War II personal memories of Miyazaki himself. I did like The Boy and the Heron more. It does fall within that World War II vibe of this corner of the bracket, which Saltburn mm-hmm. doesn't. Yes, I would give The Boy and the Heron the nod, but Saltburn just had a lot of too messy for me. It just kind of didn't really all add up. I kind of had a good time watching it, but the movie I would casually recommend, but not to everyone. The Boy and the Heron, I would recommend to Miyazaki fans. I just don't think it's top 10 Miyazaki.
Boy and the Heron, I agree with you. But Saltburn for me was just a whole lot of nothing. I didn't care at the end.
Production design, I think, is maybe fun. It looks nice.
I wouldn't recommend it. I'd have to push Boy and the Heron way over Saltburn.
Going up against number 22, Tetris. Make me an argument why The Boy and the Heron is worthy of going into the lead eight, because I have my stamp firmly on Tetris.
Totally out on the sort of trend of corporate biopics.
As a corporates go, the hero isn't Nintendo, or the hero isn't, I don't know, Sony. The hero is this like very, very small indie real life studio that was founded by like the two actual people in Tetris. Boy and the Heron versus Tetris. They're both Japanese set stories.
Boy and the Heron, I would give a slight nod to landscapes and the worlds that Miyazaki is coming from his head and sort of his history, putting that all in there.
I'm going to push back strong. My personal bracket, Tetris, would probably advance out of this corner of the bracket. World War II movies are like two-thirds of my top 10, and so a lot of them are in this corner of the bracket, including Godzilla Minus One. I will defer to Alex on this one. Boy and the Heron will advance, and it will go up against Lola, British World War II movie, when we get back around to that corner of the bracket. So we're going to have a classic World War II Britain versus Japan face-off. Let's do the last corner of the bracket and see who's going to be in our Elite Eight. Number four, Poor Things. Yorgos Lanthimos, most well-known probably for The Favourite. That's his most accessible movie. It's good. It's okay. It's not super special.
Killing of a Sacred Deer. The Lobster, then?
The Lobster is like a top of the decade for me. It's just so good. If you're not turned off by just a lot of sex, because there's a lot of sex in Poor Things.
Could swap the title with How to Have Sex, I think.
Yeah, totally exactly. Works. Arguably might be his most accessible movie now. All of Yorgos' other movies are very weird. This movie is by no means as weird, if that even makes sense. You could say a female take on Frankenstein, which is kind of a funny thing to say because Frankenstein is famously like one of the first influential novels written by a woman. And there's a whole kind of feminist reading of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And yet this very male auteur, everyone but the actress who leads Poor Things, very much sort of has like a heteronormative male vibe, which maybe some of my criticisms with the movie. And yet, you know, this is very much like a feminist movie on display. A female Frankenstein in like the 1800s or so sets off into the world, comes to her own sexual awakening. And it's going up against a very much also feminist movie, The Royal Hotel. The runner-up to Promising Young Woman 2 years ago in the Worldly Pod bracket, prior movie by the director of The Royal Hotel.
Oh, The Assistant.
So Kitty Green and Julian Garner had previously teamed up for The Assistant, and The Royal Hotel is their follow-up based on documentary. These two young women go off to the outback in Australia, work travel arrangement where they work in a cheap hotel. Some of the men in that community start sexually taking advantage of them, not full-on like, you know, rape or anything like that, but all but, and certainly make them feel very unsafe and uncomfortable. There's a documentary about that story, and this is Kitty Green and Julian Garner coming in and making a fictional version.
Gives me similar maybe vibes, like a female version of Wake and Fright, which is an older Australian movie where a guy's sort of in the middle of nowhere Australia and chaos ensues.
And it's going up against Poor Things. Women off on vacation, having to deal with the sexual depravities of men. That's number four. Poor Things, number 29, The Royal Hotel. I'll give my push to Poor Things. Production design, really special. Again, Wes Anderson-y, but super interesting to look at. Let's go to number 13, two Korean movies about romance. One of them is Return to Seoul, which came out at the very beginning of 2023, is about a French Korean lady who was adopted by a French couple who's kind of coming back to live in Korea. Overall, her relationship to her birth country over the course of like 20 years. I didn't know going into the movie, but Return to Seoul like jumps forward in time multiple periods. Past Lives is a more celebrated Korean movie about a Korean lady who becomes American because her family moves to America. And then it also jumps forward in time. Through Wave Romance, it's ultimately about her identity. How is she as a Korean-American writer? Relate back to her Korean past. In Return to Seoul, the character actually is in Korea as she kind of comes to terms with Korea. And in Past Lives, it's through her relationship with sort of a childhood crush and whether or not, you know, she wants to sort of go back and pursue her Korean identity. Return to Seoul is the movie I'd recommend further. Past Lives didn't work for me very much. I just don't get the love for it. I didn't find that it was saying that much about adult romance. It didn't seem so compelling or new. None of the acting I felt was particularly great. I actually found some of the acting a bit fakey at times. I don't recommend Past Lives. Nothing particularly interesting for me, nothing particularly special. Theme that it has running through it, you could live your life all over again. How would you do it? Or something like that in Past Lives. You know, that's literally where the title comes from. It wasn't so interesting in the way it was presented in the movie. I think what is interesting is what Return to Seoul is doing much better, which is about how the female protagonist is sort of engaging with her dual identity. That's the most interesting thing of Past Lives, and that is Return to Seoul. You really see her character development throughout the movie. She's kind of an asshole. Like, she kind of takes advantage of people around her in Korea because she's this kind of more sophisticated expat. You see her evolve over the course of the movie. I didn't like the time jumps. I felt the way she kind of skipped forward into future epochs in her life. Ultimately, I would give kind of maybe a soft recommend to Return to Seoul, or I would give a soft anti-recommend to Past Lives.
Like, if it was just me push Past Lives through, I would, just on behalf of many people I know who have it as their number one, number two, number three movie of the year.
I'm going to insist Return to Seoul go through so that everyone who had Past Lives as their number one, number two can know how wrong they are. So Return to Seoul is going to advance as the number 13. And it's going to go up against the number 20, May December. Now, May December on paper is sort of an accessible, kind of obvious movie, but it's actually a lot weirder once you start watching it than you would expect. Loaded with prominent actresses, a couple who she's like, what is it, 30 years older than her now husband. But when he was a 12-year-old boy and she was an adult woman, she cheated on her husband and had sex with this little boy. And then she went to jail for it. And then she got out of jail for it. And now she married the boy. And now, like, he's an adult and she's an adult. All that kind of like tabloid sleaze is being investigated by an actress who comes and says she's here to make a highbrow version of their past relationship. So she's going to star as the wife and kind of look back at her relationship with this little boy. But a lot of the movie is also about how the actress is sort of exploring the role and exploring the wife and looking to emulate her for a professional perspective. And this also connects to Return to Seoul and arguably Past Lives, which is about a female protagonist trying on different identities as she sort of explores a character, which is really what Return to Seoul is about. There's a very particular pacing to May December, a strong use of audio and music. There's an interview in real life that is somewhat replicated within the movie. And the real life kind of dynamic between the wife and the husband that we see captured in that interview is so much more bizarre and kind of more illuminative in terms of the tension within this couple than anything we actually see in the movie. And therefore, to me, that's a criticism of the movie, in that like the real life bizarreness of having a 2-year-old woman and her 20-year-old now husband who used to be 10-year-old boy she took advantage of. In real life, I think it's kind of even more complicated than we see in this movie.
I just think it's doing things that in none of the other movies this year, editing and sound choices that they make, it's jarring and sort of makes you take a step back and reassess what you're actually watching.
There are standout select scenes in May December that are some of the best scenes of the year. The actress character is explaining to like the high school students, you know, what it's like to be an actress.
You start losing the line of like, am I pretending that I'm experiencing pleasure, or am I pretending that I'm not experiencing pleasure?
Meta commentary on working out your identity and literally, I guess, the craft of acting. December should advance. It should crush both Korean movies. And it goes up against Poor Things. I'm going to kind of call an audible and put May December over Poor Things through. Are you willing to ride with me on that?
I am not. Poor Things for winning every matchup for me. It's my number one with a bullet of the year.
Make the case, Alex. Why with a bullet? Forget about May December. Why with a bullet should Poor Things certainly advance into the Elite Eight?
Emma Stone gives the best performance of the year, especially hearing the process of the making of the movie, where go from acting in the scenes closer to the beginning where she has the brain of a infant and then go right into her character near the end of the movie where she's like a fully grown woman, pretty much Barbie crossed with Frankenstein, and doing it better than both of those stories. The set design, the costuming, as you mentioned, every new area that was shown in the movie just was so interesting to look
at. Very imaginative. Like, I was in Lisbon about a year ago or so, and the way Lisbon is like reimagined in this movie is, it's fictional, but it sort of captures kind of the style of the town. And I thought they do that in a really interesting way. Number 12, American Fiction versus number 21, Dream Scenario. So this is the all professor matchup. American Fiction is about a black professor who's also a writer, And he's frustrated by ghetto literature getting popularized and getting framed as like black literature because he writes this kind of highfalutin fancy books. To criticize ghetto literature, he writes a very ghetto literature book, and then that ultimately becomes a big success, and then he has to grapple with what he's created. And at the same time, he's having what I find kind of a mundane and not super interesting dating relationship depending on the side, and then his relationship with his family. In Dream Scenario, Nick Cage is failed of evolutionary biologist professor. Beginning of the movie, he starts appearing in this passive role in people's dreams and he becomes a celebrity. And then those quickly morph into nightmares where he starts appearing in people's nightmares and doing horrible things to them. And that sort of parallels him going from being a very kind of passive, downtrodden type of midlife crisis type fellow to becoming a bit more kind of owning his identity. And then he starts getting into cancel culture because once he starts appearing in people's nightmares and killing them, his students and people around the world start saying he's a terrible person when, you know, he himself hasn't really tremendously changed. Both these movies, I had fun with them, have major failings for me. Dream Scenario, the last third of the movie, it just kind of falls apart. It tries to kind of do too many things because the first half is one of my favorite kind of first halves of a movie this year. Sterling K. Brown delivers one of the best roles of the year in Biosphere. He's not particularly good in American Fiction. I don't think he's given much to work with. I think he was nominated for an Oscar or something or other awards in American Fiction, which I don't understand. I thought he was one of the weaker. And to me, he represents the whole family, siblings, mom, house foreclosure, dating life, all of that going on in American Fiction, pat and non-inspired. And it kind of took me out of the interesting element of the movie, how black identity is framed in different ways and, you know, framed as ghetto culture versus framed as something more general aspirational. I do think Jeff Wright and the framing of the movie does take it into interesting places. I think I'm going to give my vote for Dream Scenario for the first half and how kind of imaginative that is. I've never really considered the Dream Scenario of Dream Scenario. American Fiction is probably the stronger overall movie, but the first half of Dream Scenario is better than anything either movie does.
Dream Scenario is a mediocre Black Mirror episode, and American Fiction would be on like the higher end of a more fun Atlanta episode. The way that the white characters in the movie are, to go along with his crazy requests that he's trying to get the book canceled before it can be published and things like that. Jeffrey Wright has been a supporting character in many movies, and he's been great. And I think this one, he really shines, and a lot of the strength of the movie is on that performance. I see that the Sterling K. Brown character oodles of charisma, and he's great in pretty much everything I've ever seen him in. Character itself was a cliche of an adult man who's coming out as gay for the first time kind of thing. And
it's a movie,
especially compared to like All of Us Strangers or something else.
And it's a movie that there's a lot of cliches, some of which are there that they're challenging, but then the very fact that they make a major character a cliche and then they give him kind of the emotional high beats, like he's the one who makes the big bravura speech. We've kind of seen this in Nick Cage before, maybe in Adaptation. There was also that kind of like sad sack. I mean, he played multiple roles in it. American Fiction gets stronger as the movie goes, while Dream Scenario gets worse as the movie goes. Yeah. American Fiction number 12 goes into the next round. Let's see who it's going to play in the final first round matchup. And then over number 5, Anatomy of a Fall versus number 28, Biosphere. Anatomy of a Fall is a French movie, couple who the husband sort of dies and the woman is accused of murdering him. Isn't quite clear to us as the audience, you know, did he fall out of the house? Did she push him out of the house? They've been having some relationship troubles. The movie introduces us to is how ridiculous and kind of the French apparently criminal justice system is. It's like clown show in there, bringing in evidence for the first time. And
everyone has an opinion on what's going on.
Prosecutor felt like such like an obvious villain. Person playing her son does a very good child acting role. I thought he lifts the movie as opposed to like takes it down. But what is amazing in the movie and why it's in my top 15, a lot of insightful commentary on what a romantic kind of relationship is between adults, how they can fight and how they can still be together. And, you know, as the protagonist lady says, and maybe in the trial scene, how can you take a few brief moments from a relationship and therefore as outsiders think you are grappling with the entirety of what a relationship is? You know, we're more than our worst moments caught on camera. The entirety of the movie, the length and kind of the core trappings are necessary to get at that kind of insight. And therefore, Biosphere, which is one of my favorite movies of the year, is an easy win. I'm going to say Biosphere goes over American Fiction. Biosphere is, again, one of those relationship movies set in some sort of near future. Two men, Mark Duplass from The League and Sterling K. Brown from American Fiction. And they're sort of like the only survivors of some post-apocalyptic world. And they're living in this like little biosphere, like igloo. They're relying upon like the fish they grow and the plants they grow and the movies they watch and the books they read together. And then things start evolving within their biosphere. First, things start evolving with sort of the animals they have. And then things start evolving with the two of them. I found it the funniest movie of the year, the most, even more than Tetris, kind of a bromance, like two guys and kind of their relationship with each other. I think Sterling K. Brown gives one of the best performances of the year. He's really good. It's a really wonderful for movie lovers. They talk a lot about Jurassic Park and Scorsese, running commentary on all the movies they watch. So for movie lovers, it's really fun. It gives you a lot of insight into relationships, straight relationships, non-heteronormative relationships. There's also sort of a magic and a hope and kind of a horror at the same time. The only thing that really doesn't work for me in Biosphere is some of the pacing and the use of music is somewhat similar to May December. It has this like funny audio beat that paces the movie throughout. Otherwise, Biosphere, one of my favorites of the year, easy win over American Fiction. Gonna go face Poor Things. Let's do the lead eight. We'll run through them and then we'll decide our number two best movie of the year, because Oppenheimer has number one. So going back to the top bracket, top left, we have Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse against All of Us Strangers. I'm going to give my vote for All of Us Strangers. Had an emotional heartbeat. So which of these, Alex, are you going to push through? All of Us Strangers or Spider-Man?
Spider-Man by a mile, I would push for.
All of Us Strangers, I think, is my number two. It is. It's my number two of the year after Oppenheimer, but it will not be the number two of There Will Be Pod. Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse is into the final four. Let's see who it's going to be facing. Poor Things, Alex said, with a bullet, deserves to be the winner of this bracket against Biosphere. Alex, you're wrong. Biosphere is a more challenging, compelling, interesting, thoughtful movie than Poor Things. Poor Things, it mainlines and it frames front and center way too much. Sex. There's so much for this character to be exploring about the world. I mean, that's what she sets off on this adventure. I thought we were going off on an adventure where she would really explore the world and explore how people are and how people are cruel. And like Frankenstein, you said this is a better movie than Frankenstein. I disagree. In Frankenstein, the monsters, what he comes to understand is how cruel and complicated the world can be. And in this movie, what she comes to understand is sexual experience. And I just find that it kind of limits a beautifully shot and produced movie, that the way she encounters the world and the way she encounters characters and the way she grows as a character, because I agree, she grows as a character in a really fascinating way. It's almost all through sexual experience. She literally becomes a whore, which I have no problem with her becoming a whore. Why does everything have to be through sex? Like, why do her and Mark Ruffalo, so much of their relationship, have to be through sex? There was so much waiting for her to explore about the world. When she walks around Lisbon at some point, that was where I was most excited to see how she would interact with people and how people would be cruel to her or people would be kind to her, et cetera, et cetera. You know, unlike Frankenstein's monster, she's beautiful to look at. You know, she's not this like ungodly monster. And Biosphere literally is about, you know, spoiling things a bit. It's about these two characters also kind of become sexual beings, but it's portrayed in such a thoughtful, considerate, challenging way I've never seen portrayed on screen. It has some of the best dick jokes. We're talking about penises at the top of the pod. It has some of the best dick jokes that have ever been made in any movie. And therefore, Biosphere with a bullet is going over Poor Things into the final four.
If totally get your point on Frankenstein and how everyone interacts with him based on physicality and violence and cruelty. Poor Things is that female version, because for many women, that is their experience growing up. Even at a young age, they'll be interacted with in ways that are sort of unwanted sexual advances and being taken advantage of by men who probably should know better, like in the form of Mark Ruffalo in this. And then
she's being raped by like a... He's like 10 years old when he's like having sex with her.
Even younger, maybe. So it's a very different way to come into the world and to experience the world. And that's why she has to find herself sexually, because of the way even her father figure and father figure's assistant, also the moment she gets to a certain point of development, are like, okay, we're going to marry her.
Oh, marriage.
And so I think that's why the focus is there, because it is female perspective of growing up in puberty and becoming an adult.
How to have sex and, you know, Barbie, and you mentioned in May, December and Return to Seoul and, you know, some of these other ones, and the Royal Hotel. Like, there's a lot of movies about women. Barbie, I think, does it better than Poor Things in that sense. And that Barbie is doing a lot more in the real world as this sort of like Frankensteinist monster. She's doing a lot more than just sort of being like, hey, I get to have sex with her. I don't know if she can have sex, I guess. But like, she's not just, she doesn't get to like LA and immediately go around asking for people to like finger bang her or something. Like, she gets there and she's like exploring the world. And like, that's kind of one of the most interesting things in Barbie, is when she like gets to the real world and how she sees things. I hear what you're saying. There's a real darkness and a horror that this is like a five-year-old in Poor Things who's being like sexually abused. The movie stayed too long with sex. Couldn't move past that. And Biosphere is a movie basically about two guys having sex, you know, just to call it what it is. And yet it does that in such an elegant way, and kind of it dances around it and then dances with it and then just grapple and then goes right at it and shows us everything. But like, if we're going to watch a couple have sex on screen, I would go with Biosphere, even though Poor Things is beautiful and everyone should go watch it. Let's see the right side of the bracket. We had the Holdovers in the Elite Eight going up against
Zone of Interest. It would be Holdovers for me. Very strong performances. Zone of Interest very knowingly
No.
does not have strong performance, very understated, and that's the intention. And
Holdovers is as conventional a movie as can be, done
yeah.
really well. And Zone of Interest is a very unconventional movie, done well in its own fashion, but because it's so unconventional, it kind of keeps you at a remove. I could almost go either way here, but I'm gonna follow your lead, and I will just say, like, Holdovers, which is like a warm hug, is maybe more also what audiences want right now than a Zone of Interest.
It's like a human movie versus the most inhuman of movies, almost.
Remind me again, what is our Elite Eight? Is it Godzilla? No, it is not Godzilla.
No.
Godzilla lost out in the Sweet 16. It is Lola, and it's going up against The Boy and the Heron. Boy and the Heron is not top flight Miyazaki, and Lola is, couldn't tell you who the director is. I couldn't tell you who any of the actors are, but they're all doing a great job. Never been a movie like Lola made before. Found footage, alternative future, relationship between siblings, Hitler movie, you know, all of that and more is kind of going on.
The Boy and the Heron was more cohesive and a tighter movie. I would,
we have in the final four Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, aka Spider-Man Sony version sequel. We have Biosphere. On the other side, we have The Holdovers against Lola. Alex, which one of these sides of the bracket do you want to decide first?
The Band-Aid and go with Spider-Man versus Biosphere here.
Spider-Man versus Biosphere. I'm gonna go with Biosphere. Spider-Man,
yeah.
Remarkable movie, really fun, does everything the previous one does up a few octaves. I didn't love the bad guy. You're like, which bad guy? Yeah, there's a number of bad guys in Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
One of my criticisms of Spider-Man is that almost too much going on, and that's its kind of style, and it embraces that. But at some point I was kind of being like, who are we following now, and like, which character is that? And then at the end it brings back all the characters from the first one who had sort of been thankfully like set aside a bit. Also, I didn't know going in that this was just a setup for the next movie, and so at the end of Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse I was a bit left, oh, I didn't get enough of a really complete story. This is one of the best superhero movies ever made, but it did have a few limitations. And Biosphere, not a perfect movie. It does things in a really elegant way, led by an amazing Sterling K. Brown, and Mark Duplass sort of tries to keep up with him, but Brown is really in a threshold of his own. And so Biosphere, I would push into the finals.
The way you've been hyping up Biosphere, I saw this coming.
How about the other side? Holdovers versus Lola.
I haven't even seen Lola, but potential of what Lola could be in my mind, which could be very disappointing when I actually do see it. I feel like I have that over the Holdovers a little bit. They're about even for me. No strong opinion on this.
The Holdovers, Lola, kind of going to channel Jim. The Holdovers is like a really sweet, good movie that we've kind of all seen before with great performances. Lola is just really unique in what it's doing. And, you know, none of the performances are like amazing, but the performances don't also have to be as amazing because the narrative and the framing and like the conceit is so interesting and curious and not just conventional like the Holdovers, that it allows like good acting and good script to be enough to sort of drive the tension in the narrative and the plot.
Quickly, I just want to say goodbye to the Holdovers. Any future movies with the two supporting characters, Davine Joy Randolph and Dominic Sessa, like, I would go see them in pretty much anything. I think they hold up well against Paul Giamatti in that. Moving over to
Lola, Biosphere, Lola. Which of these, Alex, are you more excited to see?
Oh, Lola for sure.
Oh, wow.
Hi, this is Alex back after watching both Biosphere and Lola. For Biosphere, both main actors, Mark Duplass, Sterling K. Brown, their characters were really fun and had a good back and forth relationship. And the movie had an interesting core concept, but feel struggled hard to stick the landing and ultimately go anywhere that was that interesting. For Lola, though, felt more like a sort of a mixture of Primer and Bioshock 3, as well as the found footage conceit. All of that worked pretty well, and it is a very quick movie, finished strong.
Biosphere just having a lot more that was fresh and compelling and unexpected for me, even though some of the pacing took me a bit out of the movie. The movie commentary that runs throughout Biosphere, people will sort of appreciate. You know, they like how Sterling K. Brown and Mark Duplass are sort of riffing on like all these different popular movies as they sort of try to pass the time within their igloo, in their, you know, dystopian future. Lola, though, also sort of has that because they're also riffing on pop culture from the 70s and the 60s, because they're like watching Bob Dylan concerts, but in World War II. One of the characters starts dressing as Bowie, and they suggest that she's androgynous. There's a lot that both of these movies are doing in an unconventional way while being very kind of conventional, kind of straightforward watches. Welcome to make Lola be the winner of the There Will Be Pod 2023 bracket as the number two best movie of the year.
In the street below.
King looking at all of this from the side with Cillian Murphy and Chris Nolan and the sort of 1001 actors in Oppenheimer. Lola, congrats.
You're joining August Company. Previous winners of the Robbie Pod Best of the Year movie bracket include Portrait of a Lady on Fire, Promising Young Woman, 9 Days, Tar, and this year are joined by Oppenheimer plus winner of the actual bracket, Lola.
A word quickly about Oppenheimer. We left it out of this bracket, and yet we recognized it as the best movie of the year. It really is a powerhouse, and it's a movie that invites the viewer to go back and watch it. I was turned off by the way Nolan splices up and overlays the first half of the movie in particular with such a heavy audio. But that said, the acting and the performance and the production and the themes of Oppenheimer all feel like they're operating at several levels higher than what almost any other movie not only reaches this year, but even aspires to reach this year. And therefore, Oppenheimer to me is in a class by itself in terms of 2023 movies, and therefore certainly deserves the laurels of best movie of this past year.
Alex, as we finish off, you want to quickly run down with me your top 10?
Sure.
The number 10 movie of the year, according to me, is Poor Things.
My number 10 is Dungeons & Dragons.
My number 9 is Lola, the second best movie of the year, according to the Robbie Pod.
Number 9 was The Holdover.
My number 8 is Godzilla Minus One.
My number 8 is Oppenheimer.
Okay. My number 7 is Sisu.
My number 7 is American Fiction.
My number 6 is Biosphere, the runner-up for There Will Be Pod's number 2 movie of the year.
My number 6 was Anatomy of the Fall.
My number 5 is The Holdovers.
My number 5 went out early. They cloned Tyrone.
Number 4 for me, Tetris.
My number 4, Godzilla Minus One, which in hindsight, maybe I should have fought harder for, but here we go.
My number 3 is Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse.
Oh, and my number 3, Killers of the Flower Moon.
My top 2, I think they're a league above any other movie I saw this year. My number 2 is All of Us Strangers.
And my number 2 is your number 3, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse.
What is my number 1?
Oppenheimer.
Yes. And your number 1 is Poor Things?
There it is. Yeah.
Congrats to Lola. Maybe we should, as we wrap things up, share at least who the director or the cast of Lola is, since we didn't really mention that. Okay, I just Googled Lola movie. Oh, I think I got something else. Okay, if we're going to make this our number one movie of the year, let's not... Okay, Lola is directed by who, Alex?
A gentleman named Andrew Legg.
It's written by Andrew Legg and Anjali McFarlane, and it stars Emil Appleton and Stephanie Martini as the two sisters. Alex, do you want to leave There Will Be Pod listeners with?
Forward to the 2024 movies. I don't think I've seen a single one yet this year that's new.
Appreciate you joining, and you know, happy to chat movies with you in 2024. Dune 2, the big long-awaited sequel, which is getting rave reviews. And so it's the time to tie up your 2023 movie watches and decide whether you agree with There Will Be Pod that Lola, next to Oppenheimer, arguably, is the top movie of the year.
Feel free to check out some of my lists of like top movies, and I'm on Letterboxd with ALL_IX. That's my account, so it's pretty much my only social media at this point. So
I'm not on Letterboxd, so feel free to not find my top rankings, but yeah, definitely check out Alex's rankings, and you can check out, I guess, There Will Be Pod on the Twitter X. This was great, Alex. Thanks for joining. We'll be right back.